Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in today. This is Chris Speer, and you're listening to Chefs Without Restaurants, the show where I speak with culinary entrepreneurs and people working in the food and beverage industry outside of a traditional restaurant setting. I have 31 years of working in kitchens, but not restaurants, and currently operate a personal chef service throwing dinner parties in the Washington, D.C. area. This week is part two of my conversation with Scott Blackwell, owner and distiller of High Wire Distilling Company in Charleston, South Carolina, which he runs with his wife, Ann Marshall. I've known Scott for a while now, so when we sat down to talk, we talked for about 2 hours. He's done so much besides distilling, and I'm not going to recap it all here because that's what last week's episode was. When we started talking, I didn't even realize that he had done everything from being a Ben & Jerry's ice cream distributor to having a bakery and a coffee roaster and so many other things. So because it wasn't directly related to the distilling and what he's doing now, I thought it was a good idea to kind of separate it out into two parts. But if you love entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurial journey, I think it's a great listen, and it's less than half an hour. So I will link that up in the show notes. So this week's episode, when you get to it, it sounds like we kind of just jumped right in because it is taken from that longer conversation. I've often said that High Wire is my favorite distillery in the country. I stand by that statement. I love their gin. I love their whiskey. I love their Amaro. And I think they're doing some really interesting stuff. And we're going to talk about that. You know, one of the things Scott talks about is the pursuit of flavor and having it be a really ingredient-based product. You know, he's constantly looking for better ingredients and better ways to do things. We talk a lot about Jimmy Redcorn and the conversation he had with Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills about it and how that kind of started and the transition into using more Jimmy Redcorn in their whiskey making. And something that I've been talking about a lot lately is I kind of love learning more about and digging into the creative process and collaboration. I mean, we've talked about that a lot on the show over the years. And I think this is something you see at High Wire. You know, without spoiling the whole story and everything, they did a collaboration with Alan Benton. I think a lot of people probably know about, you know, Benton's country hams and bacon and all that delicious stuff. And so you're going to hear about how he had a partnership there. You hear Scott talk about having a conversation with John T. Edge about sorghum and what would it be like to make a sorghum whiskey. Or a conversation that he had with David Shields and maybe how that turned into making a Bradford watermelon brandy. So there's a lot I could say here in the intro, but I really just want to throw it to the episode because we already talked for a while. I think there's some really great stories in here. If you love liquor, if you love distilleries, if you love Southern food, heritage ingredients, I think this is going to be a really enjoyable episode for you. And because, you know, this is a business-based podcast, if you will, I think there's some really great business lessons that you can take from this story. So I think it would be really beneficial if you went and checked out part one, if you haven't heard that yet. But again, if you're really just interested in the High Wire distilling story and hearing about the Southern ingredients that they use in making their products, then obviously feel free to jump in here. And if there's one thing you could do for me this week, it would be if you could leave me a rating and review, hopefully positive, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or if there's a platform that you listen to that allows reviews. I also know that if you found this through my pod page, you can leave a review on there. As always, thanks so much for tuning in. This week's show will be coming right up after a brief word from our sponsors. Are you a personal chef looking for support and growth opportunities? Look no further than the United States Personal Chef Association. With 1,000 members across the U.S. and Canada, USPCA provides liability insurance, certification, lead generation, and more. Consumers can trust that their meal experience is insured and supported by USPCA. Apply now for USPCA membership and save $75 on premier, provisional, preparatory, and corporate memberships, as well as $25 on student memberships by using code HAPPYNEWYEAR24 at uspca.com/join. Plus, Hire Chef subscriptions are available to list your personal chef business at hirechef.com. To learn more about membership, advertising, or partnership opportunities, call Angela at 1-800-995-2138, extension 705, or email aprather@uspca.com. I feel like there's a little gap of like, when did you start getting interested in distilling? Like, obviously you didn't just sell the business, start a distillery. First of all, like, were you a big spirit person? Were you drinking spirits, cocktails, all of that? And when did the, like, why a distillery?
Yeah. So I'll back up and say the last couple of years of owning the bakery, we had, you know, grown so much and gotten investment. And, you know, we were just on a path to be sold because private equity was involved and, you know, they have a timeline and all that. And, you know, people are always like, why would you sell? I'm like, you go from, you know, 3 million to, you know, where you're doing 4 million a month in 3.5 years. And it sounds really cool, but it's bloody, you know, and the grocery business is a tough, tough business. Not that any business isn't, it's just a, you know, it's a very tough business. So while we were doing that, though, we were brewing beer at the house. We both loved, you know, like craft beer. And this would have been in the 2009-10 era. We started brewing beer on a bigger scale. So we were doing kegs and stuff like, you know, 5-gallon kegs and stuff like that. So most of our system was based around 5-gallon batches. And, you know, I was really big on Kolsch and what I would call, like, you know, more like Pilsners and stuff like that and lower ABV beers. And at that point, everybody was like all about hops. And I was like, I just get tired of that kind of beer. I want something that's more Belgian style. I love you know, Saison DuPont is one of my favorite beers. And so I said, I want to do something more like that. And at that point, we came to Charleston to look around because we knew we wanted to move here. And I think there were 3 breweries at that point. And I think there were maybe a total of less than 10 in the state, maybe 8. So it wasn't a wild idea to open up, you know, the Northeast, the Mid-Atlantic, the West Coast, of course, was covered up. Colorado, Asheville was starting to become a scene, but, you know, Charleston was still sort of open. And in that period, though, multiple other breweries opened, and we would go to these beer stores and more and more beers were popping up on the shelves. And I would go in and I was just like goo-goo eyed over, look at this beer, look at that. And I was telling Ann all about these. And I was just, you know, obsessively consuming not, you know, as much information on all these little breweries that I could find or get. And Ann would sort of look at me and go, yeah. And I could tell she was sort of like hesitant. And eventually she popped up and said, I hate to break your heart here, but beer kind of scares me, you know, and why don't we look at spirits? And I said, what do we know about that? And she said, what did you know about coffee roasting? Or what did you know about running a packaged, you know, refrigerated dough company? And I'm like, okay, well, I guess you're right. I didn't know a whole lot, but I felt like distilling was boring. You know, when you watch them come out of the still and they're clear and they're just trickling out. And I was like, that's like watching water boil, you know? And I also was like, how much flavor comes through the still? You know, it's just alcohol, right? And here in South Carolina, you know, there was sort of this moonshine thing. And I just was like, I don't want to be cliche Southern hillbilly type business, you know, nothing against the moonshine guys. I just, you know, I just felt like that was not my personality or Ann's personality. And there again, we didn't have our grandpappy's recipe or family name or anything like that. So I thought, well, you know, we should go check it out. Let's go to a place where there's a lot of these little distilleries. And at this point, there were like maybe 200 in the country. There weren't really any in this area, maybe some, you know, moonshine guys. And so we flew out to Portland, Oregon, and they had like 12 or 15 in the city. And the first couple we visited were, you know, very mom and pop. But the third one we visited was a company called House Spirits, and he was making a product called Aviation Gin. and he was starting to make single malt whiskey, and he had been in the wine business and he had been in the beer business. And he looked at me and he said, listen to your wife, you should do spirits. This guy's name is Christian Krogstad. He created Aviation Gin, which eventually, you know, sold to Ryan Reynolds.
Huge, right?
And then Westward Whiskey, which is a single malt company out of Portland. And at this point, it was probably less than 4,000 square feet, his, you know, the place we were in. So I'm looking around going, you know, okay, well, maybe you know what you're talking about, you know. So really, you know, and I tasted stuff coming off these stills, but, you know, there again, and it was like, wow, okay, there is a lot of flavor there, but I didn't know enough about the back end process. We just, I mean, Ann was looking at data and looking at, you know, the interest in craft spirits. And there were a few businesses like St. George and Stranahan's and Hudson and, you know, people like that, that, you know, were out there, but there weren't really, you know, any crazy success stories. So, you know, I just thought, well, you know, maybe if we get into it, we can make a living. You know, we're not going to make a ton of money doing this probably, but, you know, it'll be something fun and interesting. And it's probably, you know, got as much chance as a brewery does. But we ended up, you know, taking the plunge basically based on that. And our friend owned a brewery up in Asheville called Highland Brewing. And I used to do a radio show with him, baking and brewing show, beer and cookies, basically. And we'd sit around, drink beer and talk, cook. You know, it was just silly. But anyway, we would talk about stuff afterwards. And I went up to see him one day, Ann and I did. And he said, you should walk next door. There's a distillery next door. You should check this out. And I walked over there and I'm like, man, there's something speaking from somewhere. People are, you know, continue to say spirits, spirits, spirits. And we had met with a beer distributor friend of ours. And he said, listen, I'll distribute your beer. But have you ever thought about spirits? And I was like, God, what is it about, you know, the spirit business? Maybe we should do this. So long story short, we bought a still, you know, didn't know anything about distilling, and leased this building on King Street. And we hired a guy named Dave Pickerell, who, you know, used to be at Makers and then started Whistle Pig. And he came in to consult and basically sat with us in our house because the building was under construction. And we went through grain bills and, you know, sort of proofing and barrels and, you know, all that, you know, just drilled him for 4 days. And we made a couple of batches of whiskey. And we made some heirloom white corn whiskey, which was interesting. It was, you know, it's like your first cake or whatever you make it. And you're like, you know, hell, I, you know, it actually didn't suck. You know, it was decent. You know,
so I did some home brewing. That's how my first like batch of beer, I was like, oh, this is pretty good. Like maybe this brewing thing's not too bad.
Right, right. So same kind of thing. So it wasn't, you know, it was a pretty fast paced learning curve for us. We went from that June where we distilled that first, this would have been 2013, that first couple of batches. We thought rum was going to be a big thing, like molasses-based rum, being in a port city and, you know, all that, historic, and we made rum. It did not really sell, and then we decided we would make a gin in the meantime to, you know, because we both love gin, and we thought, let's make a gin, and that'll help pay bills while we learn about this whiskey business. So it was that fall of 13 where we opened in September, and we made our first batches in the building under, you know, with the lights on and everything. But we had a gluten-free line with the bakery. So I'd worked with Sorghum and, you know, John T, and we were at the Charleston Wine and Food, and we were walking across the field during Wine and Food, and he said, distilling, huh? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, what do you think? Maybe, what about Sorghum? And I'm like, huh, well, you know, maybe that, you know, it is going to be kind of like find your weird little niche in this business. Cause you know, you got these guys in Kentucky that kind of have the bourbon thing done, you know? And so we were, so we thought, you know, let's try it. And that was really where the light bulb went off, where we made something, it fermented and it smelled exotic and amazing. And then when we distilled it, it tasted completely different than the white corn that we had distilled. And it's like, wow, a lot of flavor does make it across. If anything, distilling kind of shows the warts of flavor. You know, it pulls out everything. And so it's the opposite of what you think, or what I thought was going to be this clear, kind of flavorless, just alcohol. There's a lot of character there. And then I got excited and thought, this might be, you know, better than I thought. You know, we might have a chance at, you know, basically making a place for ourselves with, you know, this ingredient-based thinking. But I also knew, you know, from the bakery world, where our number one seller of cookie dough was chocolate chunk. You know, it was like 10 to 1. So, in other words, people aren't buying a lot of sorghum whiskey. You know, they're buying bourbon or they're buying rye, and they may buy some single malt, American single malt, but quinoa and millet and, you know, all these obscure grains are cool, but, you know, every day in, day out, most people are buying, you know, what's been bought here for generations.
Gin pays the bills, right?
Yes. So we said, you know, we need to be an American whiskey company, and that means we need to make a bourbon. And what is how do we compete in that? And I, you know, looked at Anne, and, you know, we basically came up with the idea of, like, the number one ingredient in bourbon is corn. So let's learn more about corn. And that's what led to that sort of fateful meeting with Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills in January of 2014, where we went down to the Clemson Research Center, and he had a table full of corn seeds, and he went through and educated and talked through all these different varieties, and he kept skipping over this one in the middle. And I finally said, "What's that one in the middle?" And he goes, "Oh, that's Jimmy Red, James Allen Red. Yeah, that's the one you want. That's going to be a great, you know, that's an old whiskey corn. That's going to be awesome." So I was like, you know, well, cool. I'd love to make some. And he said, well, you know, how much do you need? You know, and I said, 800 to 1,000 pounds. And he was like, God, that's a lot of corn to waste. You know, and, you know, because he's used to dealing with chefs and they need, you know, 10 pounds, maybe 5 pounds. And he's sitting there thinking, you know, you're going to do a test batch and use that much of this special stuff. And I was like, yeah, you know, and he's like, well, it doesn't exist. You're going to have to grow it. And you're going to have to, you know, work with, and you guys are going to have to write a check to Clemson, a big check to make this happen. And I was like, what does he mean by big? You know, and we, you know, because we were over budget and sort of in moving into our building late. The last thing we needed to be doing was spending, you know, a lot of money, you know, on a dirt road. And so, but I also knew that, you know, this was kind of, you know, the chance, these are the things that make you different, you know, is to take that chance. So we worked with Clemson, planted that first 2 acres of Jimmy Red, and the rest is history. And in that fall, we made our two batches and saw we could immediately see the difference, because at that point we had distilled several other varieties of heirloom corns from around the area. And I distilled it at 100% Jimmy Red because I thought I didn't want to taste wheat or rye and have it adulterated. And it was exotic and had all this stuff going on that the white and yellow corn didn't have going on. And Wayne Curtis, the writer, a friend of ours, happened to be in town, and I said, taste this, see what you think. And he tried it. He's like, wow, that's really promising. That's really cool. I said, do you think we ought to put wheat or rye in there? And he was like, I wouldn't. He's like, I think it's really good the way it is. He goes, I don't think I would mess it up. And we continued to ask folks, you know, taste this, what do you think? You know, chef friends and stuff. And they were like, nah, man, I would leave it the way it is. It's really cool, just like it is. So ultimately, that's what we did. And, you know, that's what we do today. But that's really ultimately, you know, it was really sort of like if you, you know, hear that backstory of, you know, sort of that pursuit of flavor and ingredient-based thinking, kind of like a chef would think, you know, I want a mushroom dish. You don't use white, boring mushrooms in there. You're gonna use an exotic, you know, hen of the wood or something like that, you know.
Especially as you're reducing it down and concentrating it more, right? Because the mushroom analogy is perfect for that, because you got all these mushrooms that have so much water in them, and when you cook them down, if you have this kind of plain mushroom, you're just intensifying this nothingness, as opposed to like a maitake when you reduce it all down, right?
Exactly. So that's really how we got to where we, you know, that's ultimately set the path for us. And from there, it's just been one experiment after another, sort of based on that same thinking.
You run with an interesting circle of folks. One of the things that strikes me is, it wasn't the last time I was down there, but I think the year before I went in, and David Shields is just like sitting at the bar, right? Like, and I'm having drinks with Emily, and I'm like, is that like David Shields just like chilling down the end of the bar, like having spirits? And we talked, and he was telling me about like all these, where are you from? Oh, you should grow this lettuce. I have my phone out, and I'm like, he's like, this is the lettuce you should grow, and these are the cucumbers you should grow. Like, but it seems like you have associated with some people who really know kind of Southern food and Southern food ways, which I think is cool. And it's one of the things that makes you stand out. I had your, was it like the Bradford watermelon brandy? I think maybe the first year that you had made it. I don't even think that it was commercially available. Like, I feel like you had made it for a party or an event or something. It was like a special something that you had just pulled out, and I had tried that very first year, maybe.
We didn't release it for a while. It was, we made it, you know, one thing we learned, I mentioned that we made rum and stopped. We really didn't stop. We just went deeper probably and made an agricole style rum. So we, you know, have these guys around here that grow little patches of cane juice or cane and juice it down and make syrup and stuff. And so a lot of them, though, were like, hey, you should make some rum out of this, you know. And so I was like, yeah, we should make some rum out of that, because I would love to make an agricole style rum, because it's, you know, that to me is like, it's got some rules around it, and it's also a little more directly connected to the plant, and that flavor is going to be more exotic. And I really think of it more as a brandy that as opposed to a rum. And, you know, it's French, so that's the way they thought about it, I think. And so we had made an agricole-style rum that first year in business, and David had heard about us doing some of these. You know, he called and he said, hey, you do a lot of weird things. Maybe you would be interested in, what do you think about doing a watermelon brandy? There's history of that around here. I have old ads where it was commercially available. And I said, really? Huh, wonder what that would taste like. Like nothing, you know, like water. And we got the Bradfords, and they are real squashy and funky. And one thing you know, if you taste a store-bought melon, like one of those round, you know, bowling ball style melons, compared to a lobe big, you know, old school long watermelon, side by side, you'll see, you know, they're in your area, that you'll see there's a lot of like squashiness to those lobe ones. And around here, because we have a lot of salt in the soil, they'll almost have a salinity to them, you know. So it's this pre-salted watermelon almost. So it's very, you know, interesting. So that first year when we made that Bradford, it was real sulfury and briny and had a funk to it. And we just sort of did like we had done with the agricole, which, you know, you have to rest it for about 6 months before you release it, just clear. It just has to sort of settle out. And we slow proofed it and all that stuff. And it was the same thing. We just said, let's just take that same path with this watermelon brandy and, you know, wait, you know, because it kind of was real stinky and funky at first. And then, you know, just, and then, you know, we have a lot of winemaker friends that they absolutely love it, think it's the coolest thing we've ever done because of that little weird funkiness. And, you know, it was sort of positive reinforcement for us, because of folks like you that got interested in what we were doing. And, you know, we released something, it was 200 bottles or 150 bottles. We could sell that, you know, there were enough people like us out there to buy that, those weird things. And what we were doing through all of that was sort of learning direct, you know, impact of ingredient to end flavor and sort of, you know, what if you start with this one? What if you start with that one? What if you start with this? You know, let's change the watermelon variety. Let's change the distillate, you know, where it's coming off at a lower proof. Let's change the yeast. Let's change the fermentation temperature. You know, we got to do all these things on a small scale with low consequence. And thankfully there was somebody there to buy it whenever we put it in the bottle. And so it really fed it. And you mentioned, you know, people like Glenn Roberts and David Shields and Sean Brock and Mike Lotta, who, you know, has the Fig in the Ordinary. And we were just surrounded by this great culinary scene here in Charleston. And it was just a resource for us. So we, there again, being more food people, were immediately sort of fell in with this food world more than we did the bar world. And because, you know, we approach it from that direction. And so we immediately became fast friends with a lot of chefs, and the Southern Foodways Alliance, we were part of that and had been a part of that for a long time. And there again, you know, it was full of food writers, chefs, enthusiasts. Ann and I are both Southern, you know, it's not, you know, it wasn't, didn't take a whole lot of thought to get to where we got to, really. You know, it was sort of innate, if you will.
Well, you see this in all creative circles, whether it be art, you know, I always think of like the Andy Warhol in those days in New York, or music scenes, and, you know, like a rap scene in like Atlanta or something like that. Like there's just, you build a community around these things, especially these kind of creative endeavors. So, I mean, Charleston, when I think of great food scenes, Charleston comes to mind. Like it seems like a no-brainer that all you guys are kind of building off each other.
We watched the Sheryl Crow documentary. And, you know, you just think of Sheryl Crow as, you know, like any other, you know, she had an album come out. It was a big success. And, you know, next thing you know, she had another one, and, you know, was hanging out with celebrities and, you know, eventually whatever. But, you know, if you watch that story, you know, she realized she was a backup singer for Michael Jackson, and she, you know, she like wore, and it was like really sort of didn't get to that place by dumb luck. It wasn't like, oh, I just fell into this and now I got a hit record or whatever. And, you know, like you say, you got a lot of listeners that are aspiring to, you know, start their own business, or they have their own business, and, you know, this is not going to be foreign to them. You know, you kind of make your luck. It is about being in the right place at the right time, but also, you know, having the wherewithal to kind of capitalize on that, you know. So
I was just on a podcast today as a guest, and we were talking about that, because things like me doing food writing, you know, and from the outside, people say like, wow, how did you end up, you know, writing for this magazine or being in that? It's like, because I've been networking, like I've been in the food world for 30 years, right? Like I've been going to the Star Chef conference for a decade, and I talk to all these people, and I, you know, reach out to these people when I come to town. And, you know, Jed Portman put one of my cocktails, Garden and Gun, right? But it's like, I had known Jed at that point for 5 or 6 years, and we had talked on a semi-regular basis before that happened. It wasn't like I just reached out to a stranger and said, hey, I've got this thing. Can this be in Garden and Gun, right? But seemingly from the outside, that's how those things always seem to people who don't kind of think about it.
You know, I've been lucky in that I'll be doing something and someone will come along and help. And it's like, well, you know, if people see you doing the work, they tend to want to help you. Whereas if you're just sort of sitting on the sidelines, calling the people and going, hey, I'd love to pick your brain and love to get started in this, it's like, why don't you go do something in this and show me that you're interested, and then come back and talk to me. And then I might, you know, give you some time or whatever. But, you know, there is that, you know, sort of, you do have to, I think, you know, like you said, it wasn't like we were sitting in cubicles and all of a sudden decided to start a distillery. It was a very organic path, and, you know, interest in those varietals of coffee beans also interested me in, you know, turned into an interest in varieties of corn or rye or wheat or melons or peaches or whatever, and understanding that different flavors come from different varieties, but also different growing conditions change that flavor, and different seasons change that flavor. You know, it makes it a lot more interesting, and it really is, we're just scratching the surface with really, I think, the next chapter. We moved into a new building. You know, we just realized we were kind of going to scratch out a living in the old building. And we had a lot of problems with the building where we didn't have loading dock and we didn't have any outside area and things of that nature. So we ended up moving up the road to a new building, which we have about four times the square footage and super tall ceilings. The building's got lots of character. We have a loading dock. We have outdoor space. But we were also able to increase our production, quintuple it. And with that, we also got the farmers' attention to work with us, because we were really starting to all of a sudden talk a little bit about more real money. And one thing I realized years ago through sort of social consciousness and, you know, my business is I'd always done like fundraisers for, you know, the women's shelter or, you know, foster kids or, you know, some sort of something in all of my businesses. They'd always kind of had that slant because I just, you know, felt like, I don't know, it felt like, you know, there was a responsibility there to be part of the community beyond just taking money. So, but one of the things that dawned on me through the bakery especially was the biggest place to make an impact is in your buying power. And we, you know, are now growing. This last year, we grew 350 acres of Jimmy Red, and we paid five times more per acre, or the profit was five times greater than commodity, even with high commodity pricing. So when commodities come back down, which they will, it'll be more like seven to eight times. And now our farmers look at us and go, I wish there were five more of you. And it's like, it just really shows you the power even a small business can make. So that was, you know, really a critical, what I call the beginning of our, I would say 2.5. And then now we're about to roll into the, what I call Highwire 3.0, where we're starting to harvest, I think, some of our best stuff we've ever made. We've kind of had it hidden away, and we've been diligently through COVID just kept our head down and making, continuing to make whiskey and refine our processes and stuff like that. And just sort of quietly doing our thing and basically trying to improve using the time instead of, you know, whining about, you know, we had to close or whatever, you know, it was like, no, let's, you know, let's use the time to, you know, just, it's kind of like January. I always look forward to January because that's when we can kind of catch up, clean the place really well. It's not, you know, yes, it's slow in sales, but there's plenty to do. And that was, COVID was a long January.
It sure was.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you're setting the bar high because I already feel like you have a really top-notch premier product. Like, again, your gin, the barrel rested especially, is my favorite gin to have on hand. I like to have one of your whiskeys. I love your Amaro, your Southern Amaro, which I think is a really interesting product. Any thoughts on doing anything like that? Again, like something like different, like in the kind of Amaro space or like a liqueur space, something that's not one of the main gin, whiskey, rum kind of things?
Yeah, we've you know, Brad Parsons, who wrote Bitters and Amaro, that's really who inspired the whole Amaro direction. So We were at Tales of the Cocktail and had dinner with Brad, and I was telling him, you know, I made bitters out of his book, and you know, I really, and he's like, don't get in the bitters business. There's already enough bitters people. And I said, no, I'm not getting in the bitters business. I just enjoy making them. You know, it's fun. But he's like, have you ever thought about making Amaro? And I'm like, not really, but you know, why should we? And he said, well, you know, Ann and I are not Italian. We're Southern. What business do we have making an Amaro? And he said, you know, but you've got ingredients from your area that are unique. And in Italy, that's what they do. They sort of make these Amari by their region, you know, so the southern ones are more citrusy and the northern ones are more alpiney. And, you know, I tend to love the alpine styles. So I said, well, you know, let's mess around with that. So we did multiple macerations of different things, from sorghum to black tea from our tea farm down here to Yaupon, which is, you know, the only indigenous caffeinated plant in North America.
I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, so it's spelled Yaupon, and it's from a Catawba word meaning drink. Yaup means drink, and black drink. And so it grows, and we had a bush tree thing in our yard. They're kind of scrubby looking, but, you know, you take the leaves and dry them out, and you can make tea out of them. And it's kind of like a green tea, you know, kind of a earthy green tea. So, yeah, so we ended up creating this really cool, I think, fun Amaro that's sort of, it's high proof, you know, for an Amaro. It's 60 proof, but I like Underberg a lot. So I was like, you know, I wanted something more in that style, more of what I call a medium Amari. Not super bitter, but not super sweet or cloying or syrupy. So it's not very viscous. It's more, you know, liquid because of the higher alcohol. So, you know, and it was fine. Brad put us in his book. There's a little paragraph on our Amaro, and, you know, but yeah, no, I played around with a more bitter version for sure, because I like real bitter stuff.
And I do too. Emily says I like alcohol that tastes like poison or cough syrup. So, although I don't like them super syrupy, but yes, I definitely like the herbals and the bitters and all that
stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, probably my favorite one off the shelf, just day in, day out, is Del Air Barista. And it's in that bottle with the Grolsch type top, you know, and it's super funky with that honey and smoky rhubarb root and crazy bitter, but I love it. You know, it's a true digestive, I think, you know, so it does what it's supposed to do. But yeah, so we've played around with an aperitivo. I probably would go more that direction, because I was thinking, you know, it's hot in Charleston, so I like the idea of something that would go in club soda, you know, like, you
know, I can totally see that.
Yeah. So it'd be just something a little bit, you know, not super sweet, but just with some club soda over some crushed ice, some, you know, Sonic ice or something like
that.
Yeah,
like what's your version of like an Aperol spritz, right? Like a Charleston Aperol spritz kind of thing, maybe.
Right. Yeah. So I've played around and I've got some pretty good ideas. We played around with it like 4 years ago. And, you know, we just got really busy. You know, one of our guys that came to work with us had all these ideas, and he was like, what if we made this? What if we made that? What if we, you know, did this, did that? And I said, listen, I hear you. I love the shiny objects. I love playing around. I'm a tinkerer. But what if we took all that energy and put it into making better bourbon, better rye, better gin, what the things we already make, let's make those the best we can make them. Let's use that energy and focus. And I was talking to one of our chef friends, Jason Stanhope from Fig, and he said, Kaizen, it's this Japanese theory, you know, where basically you're constantly looking to improve. And my tennis coach at one point, I played college tennis, and my tennis coach, I was out there hitting forehands, you know, down the line, whatever. And he goes, next, go cross court, but looking really good. And I said, yeah, practice makes perfect, coach, or whatever. And he goes, actually, perfect practice makes perfect.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? You know, whatever. And I ignored it, you know, whatever. But then years later, it dawned on me that it was like, I get what he means. It's doing things with intent and, mm-hmm. you know, trying to, you know, it's like knife skills. You know, if you're trying to get your knife skills so you're, you know, whatever it is you're doing, dicing, etc., and you're constantly trying to get to that perfect dice or perfect chop or, you know, whatever, or filleting fish or, you know, whatever it is, butchering, whatever it is, you're not going to be really great at it probably for the first 100 times.
Yeah.
You know, it's doing that over and over and over, and, you know.
And it's the mundane stuff that, you know, it's like, is it more interesting for me to take a dish I've made 100 times and try and make it a little better? Or is it more interesting to create new dishes? Well, it's more interesting to create more dishes, but I already have this arsenal of like hundreds of dishes. Maybe I should go back to like what I already do and do them better, kind of to your point. Or, you know, it's like, the guy who does one thing at 100% is going to be better than the guy who does two things at 50%.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is really what separates great chefs from good chefs or bad chefs. I mean, during COVID, I signed up for Masterclass and I watched all of Gordon Ramsay, both seasons or whatever.
Me too.
And then I did Thomas Keller's, all three. And Thomas Keller's for me was really impactful because, you know, it was really fundamentals and that sort of like methodical. And I'm like, this guy knows this stuff backwards and forwards.
Just watching him like dry the salmon skin with the, like he's in there with the knife. Like I've never dried my skin that well. And he's got this like side towel and right. It's things like that that you're like, oh, wow. Like you're really going to get that crispy skin because he like spends the time. Like I don't know anyone who does anything like that because right. I watched those as well. I have a Masterclass pass.
I mean, I'm not that fascinated. I think the molecular gastronomy thing is fun and cool. It was a cool thing. But I look at somebody who can cook a piece of fish perfectly. I actually admire that more, or even better, vegetables, you know, and being able, I mean, I don't know if you watched his short rib where he cooks that short rib and he goes through and it's like, oh my God, I would never do that. It takes like 3 days to cook this short rib, you know, or making, you know, a demi-glace or whatever it is. And, you know, these stocks, I mean, hell, I'm too lazy to even make chicken stock, you know, at my own house, you know. So it really, you know, we have lots of ideas. And I'll tell you something exciting next time you're down this way. That we're doing that I think is going to be really cool is we have, we're going to be creating a sensory lab. So we worked with Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills and have a 50-gallon still that's made, that was custom built for us, that mimics what our bigger stills, how they perform. And the idea really came from, in the early days, I was making tomato brandy, or I got very interested in corn, like I say, so I distilled all these different varieties of corn. Then I learned about teosinte, which is the grass that corn was originated from. So Glenn got me some teosinte, and I distilled that. So then that ended up on a trip to Mexico. So we went to a corn, a maize and wheat research center, and then down to Oaxaca, and I learned, we went to the Magos de Maiz, the magicians of maize, and learned all about these varieties of ancient, you know, corns. And I was like, shit, you know, we need to distill all this stuff. And so, but distilling 800 to 1,000 pounds and getting that out of these little farms out of Oaxaca or, you know, whatever, you want to grow half an acre of something and distill it, you're going to create a lot of alcohol that maybe isn't really going to have a home per se. It's a lot of storage and a lot of, you know, not enough, you know, you put it in barrels and kind of what's to come of that. And maybe some of it isn't that good, to be honest. So now we can create 50-gallon batches and put it in flasks and create a library so that you can come in and you can taste, you know, we got 10 different ryes or 20 different ryes and, you know, maybe even rye season to season or different yeast strains with these ryes or wheat, different wheats or different corns or different fruits. We, you know, I love blackberries. It's one of my favorite fruits. I want to do a blackberry brandy. It takes a lot of fruit to make a small batch of brandy. And, you know, I hate, you know, wasting good fruit and not having our process right. So a 50-gallon still is going to let us do that. So to that point, you know, we're going to have an approachable way to experiment that's going to be more accurate. And I'm really excited about that. The thing is still sitting in a crate in the back room right now. We haven't even had time, but the idea is to build a room that will literally be like a library with flasks, you know, end out by category. And eventually, you know, the room will be just full of hundreds of bottles of all these cool things.
That sounds like an amazing place to visit. I'm already looking forward to it. So you better get on that.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess, you know, we talked a lot about collaboration, but I think there's a big one that we haven't talked about, which is your recent one with Smoke Master Alan Benton, because I think that's really cool. When I was down there last time, you had just distilled the first batch, but you hadn't aged it yet, and you let me try some, which was friggin' hot. I mean, it was like hot off the still, so I just got to try like a little bit to kind of taste what it was like unaged and not cut down yet. So how did that come about, and like what was that like working with him? And what's been the reception to the product?
Yeah, so it was it's always fun when things like that make sense. And we Ann nor I are big smoked whiskey drinkers. You know, we don't have, you know, a bunch of scotches, or we don't have a lot of mezcal here, you know, that kind of thing. But we, you know, we're interested, of course. And, you know, it sounds cool. We, of course, love barbecue and things like that, and smoked hams and bacon and things. So it was always sort of like a back of the mind, like, you know, maybe there's a place and time where that makes sense. And we went to Oaxaca in 2019 with Glenn and some geneticists and on this maize research trip and some food folks. And we went to a village and we went around and tasted tortillas in these family homes where they had all these ancestral corns by family. And you could taste each variety by house of a, you know, through the tortilla. And during that time, one of the geneticists says, have you been to any of the palenques? And I'm like, no. You know, she's like, well, you should go to a palenque. And I'm like, I really would love to, but I don't want to go to a cheesy one. I want to go to a good one. And she goes, I know of a place. So she set up this tour with a woman, Graciela, and I forget her last name, but at this point it's Real Monero, and outside of Oaxaca City. So it's about an hour and a half drive. And we had a translator with us because Ann nor I speak really any Spanish. And we go over and they go through the whole process. And we finally go down to the Oros and they have the different agave that they had just smoked. And she's got a knife and she's cutting the fibrous outside and we're tasting it. And it's kind of like pineapple. You know, the texture of it, it's super stringy and tough. And then she cuts the heart, which is more like a, you know, a palm heart almost. And we're eating that. And I'm like, God, you know, I'm surprised chefs aren't serving this. You know what I mean? This would be kind of cool in a dish, you know, like some smoked agave. And the different varieties had different flavors, of course, and all that. And I just thought, you know, Maybe this is more the approach we ought to have to a whiskey, is more like this. And so I saw Alan at the SFA symposium in Mississippi that September in 19 and said, hey, would you ever consider smoking some of our Jimmy Red Corn in your ham house? And he said, send it on, you know, I'll totally, you know. And I said, well, it's going to be like 5,000 pounds. And he's like, yeah, that's not a problem. And I said, well, maybe you ought to take just, I don't want it to be a bunch of trouble. Just take the whole tote, which is about 2,500 pounds, and just stick the whole tote in there. He's like, Scott, that's not going to work. And I said, he goes, why don't you worry about making whiskey and I'll worry about the smoking part. And I said, all right, fair enough. So he bagged up these bags in these net bags that they hang their hams in and hung them in these old wooden racks that they hang their bacon and hams on, and hung it in there with bacon for about a week. And it just smelled, when the corn came back to us, the whole place smelled like Benton's. I mean, it had that very distinctive Benton smell.
Oh yeah. When you buy his stuff, like it smells through the plastic, right? Like when you get the bacon, your hands just from touching the pack smell like smoke.
Yeah. So we mashed it, distilled it, and it had a, you know, it's not hot in that room at all. It's a cold smoke, but it's almost, the stuff was almost yellowy. You know, the corn had turned a color, you know, the especially where the germ is, you know, up on the tip there. And we mashed it. It smelled like Benton's in the building. And then when it came off the still, to me, it had a very mezcal type flavor, almost fruit like notes, and really worked well in like a Paloma or a margarita, of course, in a Bloody Mary. And then we put 99% of it in barrels. And then our bar person said, you know, came to us later and she said, I tried the, we had two bottles of the White Dog left that we didn't put in barrels. And she said, I tried that and that's really good. We should release some of that. And I'm like, really? We've never released any white whiskey before. But she's like, no, it's really interesting. So we did that first year and the Bentons came down and we did a big breakfast buffet with, you know, the ham and sack sausage and Sharon's biscuits and had a great time. We got a letterpress, an old school letterpress poster. This guy that used to work at Hatch Show Print made, and it ended up being a total fun thing. And the Bentons, you know, were great. We had a nice article with Garden Gun written about it, and you know, it sold really well. It's still white whiskey, so you know, it wasn't flying off the shelf, but it did really well. And then we just released the bourbon this year, last month, and we sold out of the first two barrels almost immediately, and then moved into the third barrel, and we're almost sold out of that. So, and then I don't know when the next release. We quickly, of course, got some more corn up there and smoked some more, and then we've continued sending corn up there. So now he's on, I think, run five or six for us.
That's awesome. Just keep making that stuff.
Yeah, and it's unique. It's different. It's cool, and you know, really, I think fits who we are. You know, I think it's that David Shields, Glenn Robert. It's that, you know, it, like you said earlier, you can call up these folks, you know, and there's authenticity there. They know that you're not like, you know, somebody trying to capitalize on their, you know, mm-hmm. name or whatever.
And there's always going to be a place for like these generic mass marketed products. I'm talking to a lot of chefs about this right now. You know, the struggle of how much are, like, if you're a personal chef, like, how much are you buying local? Are you supporting local? Like, there's a cost associated with that, right? Like, not everyone's going to pay that cost, but like, where do you feel your place is in the industry? Like, shouldn't you be supporting these people? And the struggle and finding the balance of that. And definitely more and more people that I keep talking to are saying, like, I'm just going to dig in, buy the products that I want, support the people I want, and, you know, it is what it is, and people will find me, right?
Right. Yeah. No, it's easy to say that you're going to, you know, only buy local or only, you know, do this or that. It's hard to do. I mean, it really is a hard, and, you know, we're not by any means perfect, and we're not really where we want to be yet. But, you know, I was part of this case study years ago with the bakery, and was this group called Social Venture Network that we were part of. And I was in a room full of all these social entrepreneurs, and, you know, it was like a bunch of giants in the business. And I'm sitting in there with these guys, and he says, Scott, get up and tell your story. Tell them about this. And I was telling him, and sort of kicking rocks with my feet, you know, whatever. And he is like, no, stop. Don't beat yourself up. You're doing good things. And he goes, it's hard to walk the walk, but the thing you want to always do is walk towards that walk. And as long as you're doing that, I think people will continue to support you and help you. And, you know, it's not the easy path, you know, and you know this. I mean, it's not, you're selling to the 1%. You know,
you definitely are.
Yeah. I mean, it's much easier, you know, what is it they say, sell to the classes, eat with the masses, sell to the masses, eat with the classes or something.
anytime you have your own business, you have to make those decisions, and they're hard, and it changes over time. And, you know, right now we're going into uncertain economic times, and there's been a lot of discussions, you know, about costs and pricing and everything, and kind of looking at your model and what's going to make sense for you if you want to keep your business going, you know?
When I say that 3.0, we've got whiskey in barrels and we've been quietly sort of tucking it away. So we actually have some of the best whiskey we've ever made that has never been released because, you know, we finally, several years ago, got to a place that we were happy and started making enough that we could put it back and hold it. And so we've got several thousand barrels now of whiskey. And this year, it's going to be the oldest stuff that we've ever released. And, you know, we're graduating to that next level, which I'm pleased with, you know, what we've put out. And, you know, sometimes I'll drink our stuff, you know, I'll take a flask or something and, you know, sneak it into a play or something like that and drink off of it. And I'm like, wow, that's actually pretty good. You know, I'm sort of like, I'm surprised, but you know, I don't, you know, I'm not that happy with things I make usually.
Have you always been like that? Are you just a tough critic on yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I always compare myself to the best. So it's a, you know, it's one of the, I took one of those tests when I was in college, you know, you go to the psychologist and they take the test on what are you going to be good at in life or whatever. And they said, you know, you'll be good at this, you'll be good at that, whatever. And it was actually pretty spot on, but they said, you have a tendency to compare yourself with the best. I don't look around town and go, all right, we're the best, you know, whatever, you know, it's like, no, I'm thinking about somebody in San Francisco or somebody in Colorado or somebody in New York or whatever, and thinking about what they're doing, you know, and it's not competitive. It's more of a, you know, just, we still have a ways to go. We still need to work hard. We still need to make a better product. You know, we're not there yet. And I don't think that ever ends, but you know, I don't think it's a bad thing.
Well, as a consumer, I totally appreciate that. So just keep grinding, doing your thing. I look forward to 3.0 and whatever that's going to bring.
Yeah.
We could talk whiskey, spirits and stuff all night, but I think we're going to tie this up.
I appreciate you having me on, and it's been great to catch up.
Yeah, it was definitely great to catch up. And I would recommend to our listeners to check out your stuff. And, you know, obviously it varies from state to state and county to county. But if your stuff isn't available, you know, just talk to your local liquor store, because that's what I did here. I wasn't seeing anything on shelves, but I knew you were distributing here in Maryland. And I just said, hey, can you find this stuff? And they did. And they were able to buy some bottles. And now I can get it here in town without having to drive like previously I was driving into D.C., and now I can get it here in Frederick. If you want to try stuff, people, like, reach out.
We're solidifying our distribution this year. We're going to, you know, we're doing more and more online stuff with, you know, well, D.C. is a great state to ship out of because they have great laws. But we have a couple of shippers out of D.C. that ship. So, you know, it's pretty available if you're willing to go that extra length and get it shipped to you. And then New York, also Astral Wine and Spirits, they ship our products. And Potomac and Astra and Sealbox all carry a lot of what we make. And, you know, like even the weird stuff, like the watermelon when we make it, or the peach brandy that we just released, which was a milestone for sure. So,
well, everyone should try your stuff for sure. They're going to love it. And to all of our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. This has been Chris with Chefs Without Restaurants. You're still here? The podcast's over. If you are indeed still here, thanks for taking the time to listen to the show. I'd love to direct you to one place, and that's chefswithoutrestaurants.org. From there, you'll be able to join our email newsletter, get connected in our free Facebook group, and join our personal chef, catering, and food truck database so I can help get you more job leads. And you'll also find a link to our sponsor page, where you'll find products and services I love. You pay nothing additional to use these links, but I may get a small commission, which helps keep the Chefs Without Restaurants podcast and organization running. You might even get a discount for using some of these links. As always, you can reach out to me on Instagram at Chefs Without Restaurants, or send me an email at chefswithoutrestaurants@gmail.com. Thanks so much.